I want to introduce our chairman, Victor, the president of the Students' Union, who's amazingly well agreed to chair this debate. I also want to introduce Kada, the ISOC president on the right hand side, Abdullah Al-Andalusi, the co-founder of the Muslim Debate Initiative. To my right, Andrew Copson, the CEO of the British Humanist Association and the first vice president of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And my name is Harry, and I'm the AHS president.
I'd like to invite everyone once again for coming to this event today. You can see I'm very nervous, I've never done anything like this before. Yeah, I've just got a few things to say before we start. We are not here for a debate, and I just want everyone to respect every other person's opinion, even if it's against what you believe. And I don't want people throwing chairs at each other. I just keep it professional, I just keep it simple. And we just need to like listen to what that person has to say and just work minds together as well. And it's an open debate, everyone is entitled to their own opinion. And feel free to express your views and just have fun as well. Yeah, we've got four topics to talk about today, and I'm going to go through each of them. Same way, I believe guys on my right hand side and left hand side to say something as well. The first one is women's rights, and the question is it right for women to hold leadership positions within a place of worship and within a community? And I'll start with ISOC, and the guest speaker has got 5 minutes to speak, after which the president has got 2 minutes to speak.
Do you want to tell them about the Q&A afterwards? Okay, cool.
If you've got any questions, you can ask when you finish speaking as well. I'll only take 2 questions per topic, and at the end of the event, we can take other questions that you've got. Is that okay? Okay, you guys are online, please. Is that okay?
Yeah!
Good, thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الصلاة والسلام نبي كريم محمد وآله الطيبين وصحبه الصالحين. I greet you all with the Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessing of God be upon you. Right, well, it's a very interesting discussion today with these 4 points. I wanted to say thank the Student Union for hosting the event and the AHS for coming. My colleague Andrew Copson, always a pleasure. And we'll get straight into it, really. Now, I want to put 2 caveats, very quick caveats, to a lot of this discussion. Some of this discussion is about, which will be presented from different religious perspectives. In Islamic law is not obliged upon non-Muslims, and by dint of that, Islamic law is not obliged upon UK. So this discussion is in some way just to explain what Islam considers its position on these matters, or some of these matters, but it does not mean that we are advocating for the UK to be transformed into a caliphate, or that non-Muslims should be upon this. In fact, Islam embraced plurality, whereby Jews, Christians and others had their own law system, which was suited to their own beliefs and faith. We didn't impose the Sharia on others, on non-Muslims. So just to make that very clear, now just to maybe discuss the Islamic perspective to women and leadership positions. Now, in Islam, women can be leaders in many fields and have authority. They can be CEOs, judges, patrons, teachers, theologians, Islamic jurisprudents and transmitters of tradition, and Islamic scholars, and history bears testament to that. They can be in positions of authority, of an influence over males or females. We don't really have any concept whereby the female is denied authority if it means that she has authority over a male. And many such females in the past, many such women in Islamic history have had such authority. Islam doesn't have a clergy or a clerical organization, so we don't have issues with women priests, bishops and cardinals, because we don't have priests, bishops and cardinals in the first place. Any person can ascribe to any position within the Islamic civilization. Furthermore, women can be elected representatives in what we call a shura council or a parliament, I suppose it would be one translation, and they can be political secretaries and consuls to the leaders. Now, what we see from history is that many European travelers into the Islamic civilization noted the very elevated and lofty status that women were given in Islamic civilization. For example, Lady Elizabeth Craven, in her book, A Journey Through the Crimea to Constantinople in 1789, said, said about the society, as to women, as many, if not more than men, are to be seen in the streets, going about their daily activities. I think I never saw a country where women may enjoy so much liberty and free from all reproach as in Turkey. The Turks, in their conduct towards our sex, are an example to all nations. And I repeat it, sir, I think no women have so much liberty, safe from apprehension, as the Turkish. I think them in their manner of living, capable of being the happiest creatures breathing. We also see that Salman Schweiger, I think is the pronunciation, German Protestant minister, he went to the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century and he made this observation, the Ottoman Caliphate rather, Turks rule countries and their wives rule them. Turkish women go around and enjoy themselves much more than any others. Polygamy is absent. They must have tried it, but given it up because it led to too much trouble and expense. Interesting observation. So women never had this kind of inferior position whereby they couldn't be clergy, we don't have clergy, but they couldn't be scholars, they couldn't be thinkers, and they couldn't be philosophers in the Islamic civilization. Islam does not consider women as inferior to men in the capacity to reason, think, and come to intellectual conclusions. And there is no innate theological problem with women being a ruler. We see in the Quran, it says that the Queen of Sheba was praised in the Quran for being a very wise and just leader. However, political leadership of the Muslim community, the caliph role, is not a right upon anyone. No one has a right to be the caliph. And in how we view the concept of power is, no one has the right to have the top position of power. People are nominated by popular consultation and selected to accept it, removing them from their lives, which they must sacrifice in order to fulfill the very heavy commitment of this role. It is considered in Islam to be one of the most burdensome and theological grave and risky position, because you are the caliph is accountable for every small act of injustice which occurs under their administration. And the consequences could be very grave in the afterlife. There is no privilege to this position, no salary and no aggrandizement, and the ruler must consult with others in discharging his office and has no choice in implementing the Islamic laws. The caliph is the commander-in-chief of the army, and the role of the caliph is considered one that provides for military defense of the people. It's very similar to the Roman concept of the magister populi in this regard. But in this particular role, Islam exempts women from the burden of being subject to be called up and taken away from their lives in order to serve their community in such a capacity. This is not as a result of any inferior capacity of woman, but rather it is just an exemption, because this position is not a privilege. It's not a privilege of this position. It's considered to be a very hefty burden. And even in Western culture, there's a concept of this, of exempting women from heavy burden. You don't see people campaigning for 50% female quotas to minors, for example, or soldiers. Why don't you see that? Why don't you see feminists come out and say we must have 50% quota for people who are explosive disposal experts? Why don't you see that? It's because there, even amongst feminists, there's this tacit acceptance that basically we should exempt women from such a role. And we can get into a discussion as to why. I know that perhaps my opponent will... Sorry? I know that perhaps the opposition will say, isn't that some kind of discrimination, and discrimination or inequality? It would be discrimination if it was. It would be against men, not against women, because the caliph role is not a privileged position. You don't get perks out of it. It's actually a very kind of sacrificial role. You sacrifice your life, in essence, to serve the wider community. But we can go into and discuss where do we get the concept of equality from, and are humans subject to uniformity? Are we something that we must be completely uniform, or we must ignore any kind of understanding of biology? We can discuss that, but suffice to say, women are not precluded from positions of power and authority within Islam. But the issue of the only position, caliph, is not a right on anyone to have. No one can nominate themselves for it. They must be given to somebody, and the person who's given it, knowing the full consequences, will not be happy to receive it. And it's meant to be a position where you lament being receiving it, and then actually rejoice as you see many American presidents might be happy when they win their elections. So that's the Islamic position on the issue of authority.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay, to basically sum up the point, because that's what I could do for 2 minutes, is that just reiterate what he said about Islam and women's leadership positions in the community. So first of all, they can be anything they literally want, especially very good like educators, mothers, leaders of the community themselves. A lot of men do listen to what the wives say, especially at home. Furthermore, women can be elected for representative seats. So we've seen this in like a number of countries, such as Turkey, Iran. Even Iran has like women elected to their position. And furthermore, there's a capacity for like women to incite their own scholarship ideas. So we wouldn't have a university, we wouldn't be in this place without a woman. Islam created the first university, and the person who created the first university was a woman. And then the rest of the nation took that and then copied it from the rest of Europe. Yeah, and that's all I got to say about that.
Thank you very much. Can we give him a round of applause? I'll pass you on over now to the next one, and you've got 5 minutes.
No. Well, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Thank you very much. I think that before I get onto the direct topic of sex equality, I'm going to just spend a few seconds, maybe a minute, explaining a humanist approach to moral questions. Obviously, one of the things that we're doing this evening is looking at four questions of ethics, moral questions, and so I want to just explain very briefly the sort of direction from which a humanist approach comes when looking at ethical questions in general. So obviously, a humanist approach is one that doesn't believe in the existence of any external arbiter of human affairs. So the belief is that moral questions are questions that are to be sorted out in the here and now, that ethics is a human endeavour, that it's something the collective reference point for which is to be found in our common human experience rather than outside of humanity. Now, obviously, because of that, there are many different humanist perspectives on individual moral questions. But what they have in common is that they're all approaches that seek to make the most of human welfare and human fulfilment and human potential, and by that meaning the potential and welfare of every human person. So the desire would be to see every person in this world, including people in future generations as yet unborn, be able to develop to the maximum of their capacity and potential and ability in this life, which humanists believe, of course, is the only life we have. So when looked at in that way, the question of what is right and wrong becomes a question of what sort of behaviour, what sort of choices, what sort of actions will bring about the greatest increase in human welfare and fulfilment in the particular context that you're asking the question in, whilst at the same time avoiding harm and avoiding suffering and making sure that the basic rights of every person are protected. That involves obviously thinking very hard about the consequences of each action, trying to understand from the best research available what the likely consequences of actions are, what the current field of discipline is in areas like biology or physics or political science, so that you can really understand, having taken all the possible factors into account, what the decision that will have the greatest possible beneficial impact will be and what sort of bad decisions should be avoided. So when it comes to a humanist approach to moral reasoning. When it comes then to the specific question of sex equality, the answer from a humanist perspective is very simple. If we're concerned with maximising the welfare and fulfilment of each individual person, if we're concerned with making sure that every person has the means and the ability and the opportunity to live up to their potential, then there is absolutely no way that from the beginning of any question we can justify the exclusion from any opportunity of basically 50% of the world's population. So I don't think that there is any question at all that women or men should ever be denied automatically access to any service or opportunity or position or good in this world. you can go in great depth into the sort of evidence that you might look at to try and justify differential or discriminatory treatment. In the past, discriminatory treatment of women has often been justified by reference to biology. Oh, it's terrible. Women are unfortunately incapable by their different biology of taking this decision or that decision. The word hysteria, the origin of the word hysteria, you know, the idea that you go into a flat and can't make a decision. The origin of the word hysteria comes from the Greek for womb. And the idea was that women's wombs go wandering around their bodies and press against their brains, and unfortunately they become overheated and incapable as a result of making any sort of sensible decision. And false, totally false claims about biology like that have pervaded the history of human societies wherever men have sought to exert political power over women. So too have false claims that it's not that we don't trust you to wield power, it's just that power is a terrible burden. It really is great suffering, there's no gain in it, it's a great responsibility. And in fact, by excluding you from this sort of responsibility or power, we're not persecuting you or discriminating against you, we're just saving you. It's for your own good. The paternalistic approach that says it's for your own good, that denies women the chance to decide what is good for them and have full choice and opportunities. There's no point of view, there's no point from a humanist point of view in limiting equality to women or men. I think, as I say, there should be equal access to all roles, all perks, and also equal access to all opportunities for sacrifice and to give up a part of your own good for the good of other people. It's up to each individual person, whether woman or man, to decide what burden they're capable of taking up for the common good. To treat people as if they're unable unworthy to take up that position is to treat them as children and inferior, and that's not something that I would ever support.
You've got 2 minutes.
Thank you. So I've got to follow that. amazingly spoken. It begs the question how the ideas of the past, the ideas that were bound by the men who wrote these paternalistic texts in order to argue how people should live their lives, supposedly due to God-given will, and how to control these people, how to control women especially, through oppression, through means of control, and how they've slowly trickled through generations and generations, and how they've stagnantly still... Well, they're still there. They still survive. You know, when you have roles whereby women, you know, we don't want to burden them with that. Oh, why not? Surely we've moved on from those prehistoric versions of what women and what men can do. We are human beings. We are the beautiful gift of an evolutionary history, which should be, in all honesty, should be celebrated. Because of that, it is demeaning, it is insulting, and it is not very nice, should we say, to continue to argue this rhetoric of segregating the two different genders. By doing so, all we are doing is stagnating this view further. By doing that, what we are also doing, if you really think about it, is developing this within our mind, that this is the way it is. So, for example, if we see women as this vulnerable, susceptible human being which can't control their emotions or whatsoever, how dare we, how do we allow them to take on such roles within society? They're not fit enough to do that. Surely we've come further away from those views and those beliefs, and probably we haven't, unfortunately. Yeah, that's me.
Thank you very much. Now I'm going to give the guest speakers 3 minutes each to counter argue what each person has said. Who would like to go first?
It's me.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that they might be addressing some points which are perhaps kind of Eurocentric issues with maybe how women were treated in the West throughout history. But in Islam, women aren't treated as inferior or children, or they're unable to do things, or that they are exempt from the caliph role for their own good. There's no narrative or discourse of that in Islam. Rather, Islam really just recognizes something, which is that humans are not uniform. and that human beings all have are specialized. We have specializations, and we have certain proclivities, you know, human nature, and so on and so forth. Now, it doesn't mean that women are denied opportunities for sacrifice. Many women just being good mothers it's a daily sacrifice that they have to go through. And I don't think I could cope with what I've seen my mother go through. Not because of me, of course, but just trying to be a good mother, or even women who go out and be good scientists, and even women who join the army, which Islam permits, women can join the army, and they've sacrificed their life in the just causes. So Islam doesn't prohibit these things, and we shouldn't. But, you know, perhaps project a very Eurocentric history onto the Islamic civilization, which they're probably not doing, but they probably wrote their presentation in anticipating perhaps another opponent, probably. However, Islam believes that we're not just individuals, that we are social creatures, that we have different specializations. If aliens came to Earth and they studied humans, they would have seen, well, what's these two types of humans? You know, a man seems to be a modified female, as Lewis Wolpert, a biologist, mentioned in his book, Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? The Evolution of Sex and Gender. Right. So evolutionary biologists have concluded that there are basic proclivities, and there are differences, that we, you know, men have more testosterone, they're more, this has certain effects, which you can see by differential of numbers between prison statistics, more men in prison than women, and a number of other things they noticed with developmental stages of a child. Now, all Islam says is, you know what, it doesn't say that, oh, women can't do it, and they must be prohibited from doing stuff. No, it doesn't say that. Women can participate and have participated in ruling, in advising the caliph, being the caliph's advisors to Umar, Caliph Umar, one of the companions of Prophet Muhammad, he had a woman as his advisor, and he had there were women street judges, not like Judge Dredd, but street judges. We have a concept of going out administering justice in marketplaces and so on. Women can do that. That's not a problem. The issue is that the caliph idea is more of an extrapolation of the men's role, which Islam defines, which men are thought to be specialized to, which is defense and protection of the community, which might require physical the defense and protection. And Islam just apportions that to men as part of a higher narrative. Now, if you are an individualist and you want to believe that there are no higher narratives for human beings, then that's fine. We can ignore biology, and you can say, let's just make up the rules for humans as if biology, evolution, or whatever belief you want to believe in had played no part and has no effect. We're just disembodied intellects that float around and can be put in any particular situation we want to, absent of any context that we emerged from. So all Islam is, it's not saying women can't do stuff. It's rather saying that there are certain specializations within the human species, and Islam encourages humans to play up to certain proclivities. It doesn't say that women are incapable or unintelligent. As I said, the Queen of Sheba is praised in the Quran as being a wise and just leader. If Islam was against women ruling, it wouldn't have praised the Queen of Sheba in the Quran. So we just have to avoid strawmanning traditions, because maybe Europe had a very bad past of how it treats women. Doesn't mean that every other civilization has the same perspective or even the same worldview.
Thank you very much.
Well, I don't really mind what the history of Europe is, nor what the history of the Ottoman Empire is. I mean, nothing that I said was about that, so there's nothing really for me to respond to. I was talking about a humanist approach to equality between men and women now, and what I said applies as much to the notion of a job of a caliph in its political sense as to any other, but I don't particularly mind whether that post is restricted to men or women or not, since neither myself nor anyone I know is ever likely to occupy that post. It's obviously a matter for people who care about that sort of thing, which I don't. I agree that humanists are not uniform. Humans. I mean, they're not uniform either. But human beings certainly aren't. I agree that humans aren't uniform. I think that everyone has different talents and capacities and abilities. But I do deny that the principal dividing line between categories of people is men and women. I think that all the evidence of psychology, for example, if you look at something like the evidence of current research into intelligence, shows that there is very little that correlates to gender in the world of intelligence. Men and women are not so different as centuries of attempted social differentiation between the two has made out. Now, of course, there are physical differences that are very obvious in the right circumstances between men and women, and obviously those differences have a biological function, But I'm sure we've moved beyond the point at which biology dictates our whole society. I mean, biology is no longer the foundation of the civilization that we live in. If it were, then half of us would be dead for a start, because we would never have cured ourselves in infancy through medicine or other technologies of the diseases that would have killed us off. So I really think that the whole question of sex or gender differentiation is, to me, an extremely unimportant one. I really don't think that there are any rules at all or positions at all, as I said a moment ago, that should be disbarred to one gender or one sex or another. Apart from that, there's nothing really in what was said just now for me to argue against, because to some extent, of course, we just take a fundamentally diametrically different sort of position.
First of all, to be Muslim, you have to accept that it's revelation from God, and there is wisdom behind everything that He tells us to do. And as Muslims, our ultimate goal is to become closer to Allah, one God, the Arabic word. And we're given those opportunities to do this. And just because those opportunities are a little bit different sometimes. And yeah, you want to talk about inequality? Yeah, the only inequality is that men don't get as much advantage as women do. Because actually, it's a mercy for women not to take on the collateral role. If I'm thinking about another thing, you speak a lot for the Muslim women, and you're saying, well, we don't think it's fair. Well, actually, if you ask us, we're all right. Does anyone want to be collateral anytime soon? No, we're all right.
I didn't say anything about Muslim women at all. I mean, I understand your point of view entirely, and that's entirely your choice.
Just to kind of reiterate, the role of caliph is an imposed role, as in the person who receives it didn't ask for it and can't say, I want it. In fact, they do, they disqualify themselves, but it's imposed. They are selected in one way, almost against their will. They're selected to do it. So it's an imposed role, not a role whereby you say, I want it and I want access to it. And then you get it. I think also, just another point, I think it was just very interesting, is it's correct what Andrew Copson says, that we have some different kind of world views here. So maybe humanists have a more individualistic perspective on the matter, whereby humans are treated as just individuals whose concerns are purely material in the material world. Or at least not beholden to a higher narrative, whereas in Islam, all humans are beholden to a higher narrative greater than ourselves, which defines our roles in life, gives us purpose. Perhaps the difference is we are given purpose. And so we have many attributes about ourselves. So if you're a person of great intellect, then maybe your role in life is to do something which uses your intellect. And if you're a person of great strength, maybe your role, if you see you can do it, is something that involves manual labor or something like this. However, when it comes to the differences in gender, Islam gives specializations which allow both to integrate and complement each other for a greater, higher purpose. It's not an inferiority of one or the other, it's symbiotic between the genders. And that's the kind of the how the Islamic approach is to that.
Thank you very much for that. About someone there, if you write your questions down, I'll ask, you can ask at the end of the debate. I'm sorry. Do you want to ask a question?
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah. Who is your question directed to you?
Sorry?
Who is your question directed to?
Is it took a while to get there, but eventually in your second speech, you finally defined why it was that women couldn't hold the role of belief. You said it was because it was more of a role of physical protection. But several times in your speech, you also referred to you being quite happy with being soldiers. So I'm just wondering how the two match together. Surely if they could serve an army fighting a war, then they'd be well suited to the protection.
No, I didn't say that was the reason for the exemption for women. The exemption for women is as Muslims describe it, is it's a mercy. They don't have to be in fear that they're going to be plucked from their lives against their will and be made to serve the community in a very, very harsh job role. But rather, I said that the position of caliph is an extrapolation of the male role in envisioned under the Islamic narrative of being the protector and the maintainer of that society. So it's an extrapolation. As I said, it's in a way, it's very common to the magister populi in the Roman concept, whereby one person is, in times of war or something, one person is selected to be the defender of the entire community. It's similar in that respect, but it's more permanent. So it's an extrapolation of the narrative, but not that women can't be in the warfare, and even in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, women, you know, did involve themselves in military campaigns. You know, they weren't denied, they weren't expected to. Men are expected by obligation to be reservists and to defend society and be enlisted. But women, it's not obligatory for them to do, but in Islam, we don't prohibit them from volunteering to join the army. So I'm not saying that women are prevented from being a caliph because they can't, you know, hold a gun and go outside and do and be like Rambo, right? What we're saying is that in a way, the caliph's role is an extrapolation of the male the male role within a society, whereby the males are, you could say, the soldier ants of the society, and the women are, well, the queens, for want of a better analogy. So that's really what it is. It's just rather an extrapolation of a narrative. But Islam provides a purpose narrative for the different gender roles. Of course, if you're from an individualistic perspective or humanistic perspective that Andrew follows, then maybe you don't believe in such narratives, and maybe you believe that I said we can just be disembodied intellects without much effect of our biology. If that's your belief, that's fine. But this is only for Muslims who believe in a higher narrative. As I mentioned in the beginning of my presentation, this is not for non-Muslims, and it's certainly not advocated for UK, because it's non-Muslim country. So it's only for those who believe in that narrative, and that's how it works out for those who adhere to the basis for that narrative.
Thank you very much for that. If anyone has got any question, I'm going to ask you a question.
Yeah,
okay, I'll give it to you. But
yeah,
Andrew and Harry.
Yeah, so close to yourself, saying something that quite bounced back on me when you said you didn't care about the Khalifa position. I find that quite, I think you shot yourself in the foot somehow, because it's a debate and we're talking about two different ideologies, and
In what way exactly?
Because you said that you didn't care, so how can you address an ideology when it is when it's established, its form in the government is, you have a caliph, but you haven't addressed that, so it tells me that you haven't done your research and you don't know about it.
Well, I mean, I've been asked to give a humanist perspective on equality between men and women.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been giving. I don't know what's Eurocentric about talking about equality between men and women based on biology and.
You were saying that one of the excuses that is given is that you know, we're going to try and save you, but that is actually a narrative in the European sense and not in the Islamic civilization.
Okay, I understand your question. I think that the idea that the exemption of women from certain categories of duty is a mercy or is a benevolent act has come across in what's been said about the particular position of the caliph. It's certainly also present in European civilization and in civilizations in most parts of the world. I mean, Mary Wollstonecraft in the late 18th century in England, when she wrote her Vindication of the Rights of Women, talked about this specific proposition. She talked about how men often, when they wish to reserve a certain power for themselves, will say things like, it's a mercy for you not to have to do it, you don't need to worry about this. And you're exempted from this great duty or burden. I think that's a common pattern. I mean, I find it all over the world and all over time. So I think that's the same sort of reasoning that has been heard, though, in defence of the keeping a position of caliph restricted only to men. But in fact, I mean, when I said I wasn't concerned about it, I think there is, I mean, obviously there are some of the values that I hold that I wish that everyone would adopt, of course. That's in part one of the reasons why they are my values. You know, I think they're good ones. And I think most people with strong values of one sort or another would desire those values to be shared. But I also recognise that when it comes to the self-organisation of certain groups or people for their own specific purposes, there are roles and responsibilities and jobs that they may wish to restrict to certain people based on different factors, one of which might be sex. And I think that in a situation where everyone involved has consented to that restriction, there is a case for saying that other people shouldn't interfere. And so that's what I mean by that I'm not particularly concerned about that position. Now, if I were to, and that's why, for example, when sex equality laws were brought in the UK or in other parts of Europe, there were various exemptions from them for things like imams and priests and so on, saying that those jobs could be restricted to men in UK employment law, unless the groups involved decided they wanted to open those jobs up to women, which has happened, for example, today in the case of the Church of England. So that's my meaning when I say that it doesn't particularly concern me, that role. Of course, in a broader sense, I wish that everyone would embrace sort of full gender equality, but I think we have to recognise we live in a world where not everyone is going to agree with each other, and so I think sometimes we have to recognise that right to disagree and to organise in a different way. But I don't think that's a Eurocentric position at all. I'm rather confused by that charge. Nor do I think that human beings can exist as disembodied intellects. We are very clearly embodied personalities, and that does restrict what we can and can't do. What I deny is the idea that the main dividing line between groups of people is gender.
Thank you very much for that. If anyone has got any more questions, there's some papers being passed around. If you just write your question down, we'll be able to ask at the end of it. Oh, okay.
Should we make a question to yourself? In Islam, it is harmful for a woman who's on a period to go into mosques or pray, stuff like that. And I think when a woman is on a period, that's a very natural thing. So I'm just wondering, why does Islam discriminate against that?
Okay, well, so your question is, why does Islam prevent women from praying while they're on their period?
Or going into a mosque.
Okay, I mean, the issue is, it's about just, ritual purity for ritual prayer. Women can make supplication whatever their state, and so can men, right? You can always make supplication. Christians only make supplication, right? No, Christianity doesn't have a ritualized prayer apart from that, the once a week mass services, whereas for Muslims we have five times a day. During the time when women experience a period, they are exempted from doing the ritualized prayers as a mercy, because they might be feeling weak, they might be feeling a whole number of things, whatever the case might be, they're exempted from it. But at all times, they can always make supplication to God. There is no restriction. It's not like, oh, the channels are shut off between you and God while you're on your period. None of that. So it's only for the ritualistic prayers, the five times a day ritualistic prayers, they're exempt from doing that while they're on their period. Also, if a man is cut and bleeding, he can't pray while he's bleeding as well. So it's not the issue of women become intrinsically dirty. No, it's that blood itself negates what we call ritualistic purity, although, and so that has to be stopped before that person can pray. So it's not about just women. Man's blood invalidates a man's ritualistic purity too. So it's not about men and women. It's just about the state of someone to do a ritualized prayer. I think I would just like to just add one kind of interesting thing. We talked about, from the humanist perspective, this perhaps would be a perspective that I would like to argue one particular point, the issue of equality. I would say that equality can't be justified without reference to a greater narrative, a divine being which establishes equality. Because humans, as you said, humans aren't equal. But if humans aren't equal, and certainly in nature, nature doesn't care about animals being equal, then they're not the strongest might survive, or the ones who are more fittest to pass on their genes will be able to do so, and the ones who are not, nature doesn't care about equality and making sure everything's equal. So then where did we get this concept of equality if nature doesn't care about equality? The only where we get it from is that in the eyes of God, as Muslims we believe, all humans are equal in the eyes of God. Your soul is fundamentally equal in the eyes of God. However, you might have been born in a rich family. You might have been born to wealth. You might have had intellect or great strength or better immune system or a whole number of things, advantages you have in life, which other people don't have. But of course, we say fundamentally equality is preserved in the hereafter, because the more blessings you receive in this life, the greater your accountability is in the next life, and the greater your responsibility with that those blessings that you receive. So a poor person will have a much easier day on the day of judgment than a person who is rich, who's been given a lot. So I would say that if you don't believe in a God, then the idea of equality is just a vestigial remnant from the Christian past, which liberals or humanists imported or kept preserved, but they lack any basis to justify, except to say, well, I like this idea. Well, that's great you like it, but you can't justify it. Whereas I would argue that those that had a religious background, either Christianity or Islam, there is a basis to justify it, because in nature, nothing's equal. Nature doesn't care about equality. Evolution doesn't care about equality. It doesn't exist. So how are we equal, I'd say, in the eyes of God?
I realise there are three more questions on the agenda, and the chair has been cavalier with the running order so far, which I suspect might be his natural style, which is fine with me. But I think I would like to just respond to that point, if that's all right. There are two claims that have been made there. Firstly, that the idea of equality between human beings makes no sense if you don't have a divine guarantor of it, a divine reference point. And the second claim seemed to be that actually, if you believe in life after death, that's a greater idea of equality, because people who've suffered in this life will be better off after, and people who haven't will be worse off after. They seem to be the two claims. But to take the first one, the idea that equality only makes sense if you have some sort of divine arbiter for it. Well, clearly there are societies across the world that have evolved theories of equality that have had nothing at all to do with a monotheistic God. That if you look at the idea of equality before the law in ancient Athens, it was explicitly based on the idea of this being a contract between human beings with no divine intervention between it. Isonomia is the Greek word for it. There are clearly various other non-Christian, non-Jewish, non-Muslim, non-monotheistic ideas of equality. This isn't to say that any society has totally lived up ever to the idea of equality. Certainly even Christian and Jewish and Muslim ones haven't. But there are plenty of ideas of equality that have nothing to do with the idea of a divine guarantor of it. My own commitment to equality stems from my acknowledgement of myself as a human being, the fact that I see something similar to myself reflected back to me out of the faces of other men and women in this world, and my desire to be treated well, and my desire, therefore, and feeling of obligation to treat others well in that same sense. And in fact, there are good social arguments for equality too. The evidence of something like The Spirit Level, a great book written about social equality and inequality, shows that even the best off in societies are happier and healthier and have longer lifespans and better outcomes if the society is more equal than if it's more unequal. So equality, it can be a practical, pragmatic, deliberate, human-created here and now concept. It doesn't have to be referred to some sort of external concept. And to say that it does is to deny the reality of social history, and also to insult people who live their lives on the basis of that principle. The second idea, the idea that equality somehow makes more sense if you sort of smear it out over eternity, so that people who've suffered in this life can then benefit in the next life. Well, that may be true if you believe in an afterlife. I don't, so that doesn't work for me. But also, I question whether that is equality either. For example, it's not something great about you that you've been born poor and have suffered all your life. It's just a coincidence about your life. So I think it's questionless why you should therefore benefit forever from the circumstances of the short life that you've lived in the here and now, and vice versa, why you should if you're rich. That doesn't seem like equality to me. That seems like very discriminatory treatment based on a very short period of existence compared with eternity. But maybe you're going to think about animal rights now.
Thank you very much.
I'll clap myself, shall I?
Thanks to everyone that contributed to that topic. We're way behind time, and I'm going to stick to my timing for the next sessions now. The next topic is on animal rights, and the question is, are the ways in which animals are killed for food important? And I'm going to start with AHS and Dorf ideas.
Okay. Well, I don't think this will take me the whole 5 minutes, so maybe we'll catch up with ourselves in time. And the question is whether or not the ways in which animals are killed for food is important. I don't have much difficulty in answering this question. I said at the beginning that one of the tests in which a humanist approach applies in order to find out whether something is right or wrong is the test of suffering. Now, obviously, the most obvious sort of suffering that we are aware of and can understand is human suffering. But increasingly, as we've learned more about the rest of the animal world, those animals to which we are related through biology and have, you know, close familial bonds with through our evolutionary history, the more we see that other animals too are capable of what we recognise as suffering. This is extremely evident now that we know more about the brain chemistry and behaviour of other mammals. We can see what in human beings we would term fear in the behaviour of other animals, animals other than ourselves. And even so long ago as the humanist philosopher Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century, a humanist way of thinking applied the test to the way of treating other animals. Not can they reason, this is a quote from Jeremy Bentham, not can they reason, but can they suffer. And I think that because other animals very clearly do show evidence of suffering, then we have a moral obligation to them to minimise the suffering so far as is possible. Now, many people would say that means that we should, in fact, not kill animals for food at all. There are many people to whom a vegetarian approach to life makes more sense given this reasoning, the fact that animals can suffer and the fact that we have an obligation to minimise suffering or desire to do so. There are other people who can't quite bring themselves to that conclusion and so are going to carry on eating meat, and those people will have a legitimate desire to want to minimise animal suffering in the process of meat production. I think both approaches are something to recommend them. Clearly, with the technological advances that we've made, we don't need to take in calories from meat in order to live. But equally, if we do want to do that, we're able to determine what ways of killing animals for meat will produce less suffering, and I think that we should do those experiments and take those paths.
Thank you. But, 2 minutes.
Thank you. Animal rights come before religion. Now, I made that statement because if you think about it, or please do, animal rights, we are social animals, we are human beings, we are part of the same animal kingdom, we are evolved. As Andrew rightly argued, you know, we do have genetic biological links to these other animals, to these other beings, and the argument of sentience, the argument of suffering, is completely significant when we talk about how animals are killed for food and whether that is important. So, personally, as a vegetarian, obviously my ideas are going to be biased towards that, so I'll keep them to the side. If, for example, meat production will stay, which it will, it's not going to die out, that is an agreeable, I guess, fact. What I will say is that we have to ensure that the suffering for those animals are reduced as much as we can. And in order to do that, religion doesn't have to play a part. We are therefore... Oh, the TV's come on. We are therefore responsible. I know, right? Saying goodbye to the lamb going to slaughter.
That's right.
We are therefore responsible for reducing the amount of suffering in that animal's life. I don't think there's anything else that we could possibly say. So, yeah. You've got one.
It's finished.
Stop.
I'll pass the mic with you. You've got 5 minutes as well.
It, but first, I just want to iterate the Islamic position for animals is certainly one of kindness and mercy. We see that animals are not allowed to be subject to unnecessary suffering. A work animal cannot be overburdened. For example, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam forbade anyone from putting too much load on top of a camel, on top of a donkey. One of the companions of Prophet Muhammad took some eggs from a nearby bird. The bird started following the eggs and was very distraught. And the Prophet said, "What's made this bird distraught?" And he said, "Oh, we took some of the eggs." And said, "Well, return it back to the bird." because you know basically this mother bird has attachment to eggs. You can't make her basically have this you know anxiousness by taking away you know her eggs. So in Islam, we have a concern for the well-being of animals and that the animals should not suffer, and that's very much part and parcel of Islam. However, the issue of animal rights when it comes to eating, because we do eat some animals, that you know basically as humans do in most cultures and societies. It does bring up an interesting question of equality, because obviously they suffer, we suffer, they experience the world, we experience the world. Could you not argue that they deserve equal rights to human beings because they have a similarity? Of course, someone might say, but they're not having the same intelligence as human beings. Okay, but then if that's your logic, then would you say that those who are, let's say, not as intelligent as you amongst other human beings also deserve lesser rights by that same criteria? Does intelligence necessitate right? So how do you justify equality from a material perspective? Right, even the ancient Greeks, which he cited, they didn't treat women and slaves equal to their males in ancient Greeks. And I think it was Aristotle, or could be Plato, I forget which, who said that identical things should be treated equally. But humans aren't identical. So how would you justify that? And also animals are not identical to human beings. So I think that was probably maybe a response to maybe your previous point, just to show that it's still not as clear cut, because even the ancient Greeks had inequalities, and they justified those inequalities saying that women and slaves are not identical to free men and so don't deserve to be treated equally, even though they espoused equality, the idea of equality. So everyone has a different idea of what equality is if you are trying to base it on an arbitrary materialistic perspective. And just having similarity of something doesn't guarantee equality. I could say that chair is equal to me in having matter, but does that mean me and the chair are equal? No. I'm very comfortable sitting, of course, but the issue of animal rights now, Andrew actually kind of preempted this one point I was going to mention, when I do agree with you on this, which is if cruelty is unnecessary suffering, it's not necessary for us to even eat animals in the first place. Our eating animals is really a convenience of our tastes, for example. So then, if it is allowed for that reason, unless you are vegan, of course, but my counter-argument to vegans is nature isn't vegan, so how do you justify veganity when in nature, animals eat each other all the time? Natural law of nature doesn't care about being vegan or vegetarian, unless you are of a particular species which only eats vegetables. So in that respect, if you can justify eating animals based on the fact that it's your convenience, your taste, then how much more so do you believe if you believe that you slaughter them by getting rid of all the blood out of the animal, that this is not something that can be done as well, because it's part of our belief, it's part of something that we actually believe in. Now, there is another debate as to whether stunning or animal slaughter is more humane. And there are arguments on both sides of the fence saying that, you know, stunning doesn't always kill the animal in the first shot. Some animals, many animals have to be shot a few times with stunning. According to Animal Aid UK, they looked at, in one Somerset slaughterhouse, 12.2% of sheep had to be stunned more than once. 89.6% of pigs had to be stunned more than once, although I don't justify eating pigs, of course. But in Dorset, 12% of cows, and in Derbyshire, 2.5% of cows had to be stunned repeatedly. And now that causes pain. Now there is a debate, and I'm not going to wade into a statistical and scientific debate as to whether animals feel more pain if you cut a jugular vein and wait for the blood to be drained out, and they just die from loss of blood. And also as blood loss you know occurs, they have shock and they have less feeling. Of course, I'm not going to have a scientific debate on this, because that is still being debated by scientists, and none of us here are scientists, I don't think, anyway, on this matter anyway. But what I will say is that if you justify that animals can be slaughtered for meat because of human convenience and taste, then how much more so would you have to also permit, morally and ethically, that animals can be slaughtered by a ritualistic method based on people's beliefs? And of course, even under the ritualistic method, it is not gratuitous. In Islam, there is many rules. I can't speak for kosher, of course, because I'm not a Jew, and they know better than I do. I haven't studied it. But at least in Islam, the animal is not meant to witness other animals being executed. They're not meant to be mistreated, beaten, or hit, as they are done in many industrial farms today in European countries and around the world. So Islam, you have to treat the animal with respect, and it's purely that the animal doesn't see the knife until it's just about to, the ritual slaughter is about to occur. And that's it. Really, in Islam, all that's required is that the animal is not basically killed and dead while still having blood in its veins, because we view that as carrion, basically. You're eating the carrion meat. So this is really just the rule. So on that basis, we must be then consistent. The only person that could viably argue against my position and the position that you can slaughter animals for convenience and taste is a vegan. But even vegans could not justify, based on natural law, why they should be vegan. Because in nature or evolution or whatever you want to call it, doesn't care about animals eating other animals. In fact, it's part of the life cycles of many animals who only eat other meat and bugs or insects and all other living things that crawl and walk the earth. So I think these are the considerations. I think we both agree that it's not necessary that we shouldn't kill animals in ways that cause them pain unnecessarily. But when you believe it's necessary, as a Muslim, for example, or as a Jew, then you have a better reason than someone who wants to kill an animal purely because they like their McDonald's burgers. Thanks.
The ways which animals we could limit suffering has not existed yet, because even both worlds, even religious or non-religious theologies, have never come up with except for Islam, have never come up with a certain way of killing the animal quickly to lessen its suffering and to feed us. Normally, when you see around the UK, when you hear all this stuff about animals being caged in and being really stunned, like constantly, as Abdullah just stated with his data, it should not have even come up on the topic. As like animals do not know, like if we don't know how animals suffer from pain, we don't go inside their brain or stuff and just like feel every emotion they do. So by limiting pain, this is like limiting on how quickly they die. And Islam has come up with the most effective way of killing the animal quickly rather than stunning it constantly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll give you a question to
Kanza. Oh, okay. Well, I don't have very much to say. I think I'll say two things. First of all, to stand up for the vegan position, though I'm not a vegan. Are you a vegan or a vegetarian?
Vegetarian.
Oh, well, you're not enough then.
We need
not hardcore enough. a vegan, to say that it's an argument against the vegan position, that in nature there are, human beings are not vegans, or that nature is not vegan, is not to argue against the vegan position, because the vegan position is not that they're going back to a state of nature. The vegan position is that animals suffer through the processes of meat production and meat slaughter. A vegan does not want to be a party to that suffering, does not want to be committing that suffering on other animals, and has therefore said that they will not do so, has conscientiously refused to do so. Nature's got nothing to do with it. I don't see how nature comes into these moral questions in a negative way at all. So I think that nature is a red herring in terms of animals and their suffering. I agree with Abdullah that the thing to do primarily is to find the means of animal slaughter which causes the least suffering. I disagree about the extent to which the experiments that have been conducted and the expert literature has or hasn't identified that. The Farm Animal Welfare Council in this country did say that pre-stunning of meat is the best way to guarantee a reduction in suffering. But I think I agree that neither of us are scientists on this matter, and there's very little point in getting into the technical details. However, we have at least reached some agreement, which is that the decrease in animal suffering is desirable, and we should be led by the evidence as to what really does most decrease animal suffering. However, Abdullah then went further and said that even were the amount of suffering to be greater under the methods prescribed by religion, then still it would be okay, it would be moral, to allow those religious exemptions from animal slaughter laws, because we ought to give a greater respect for religious prohibitions and rules than we do to matters of other taste, other preferences. And I can't follow him directly down that as far as that, down that route. I think there are probably are humanists who would say, yes, you're right, the religious feelings of human beings should count more than the suffering of animals, because we sort of give a greater weight to human beings in this matter than we give to animals. I am not inclined to see religious preferences as that different from other sorts of preferences, and so I think I would give them a lower weighting, and I might possibly increase the weighting that I would give to reducing animal suffering. So I would be ready to argue for the prohibiting of certain methods of animal slaughter if they were to be found to increase animal suffering, even if they were religiously required by some religions.
Thank you very much.
Well, then I think we've reached perhaps an agreement on, I suppose, where the basis for morality comes from. I suppose, in a material perspective, human taste. In a material perspective, it's human taste. So vegans have a taste that they don't want. Their taste is they don't want to see human animal suffering unnecessarily, and eating animals is unnecessary. Therefore, that it is greater suffering for the animal to basically go with your taste for burgers and see animals be slaughtered, so it's best to reduce that, and that's their taste. The human taste is saying, well, I do like to have a burger, so because of that, I want to follow that taste. Animals, should be slaughtered in abattoirs, and and their conditions, although we should try our best to make it as comfortable as possible, but ultimately they're going to have to endure the possibility of being stunned multiple times and being locked up in buildings and enclosures and things, as is the requirements of necessity for industrial production. But I say, of course, as a Muslim, and I don't say it's my taste, but I suppose maybe humanists would interpret it that that's my taste because I believe in God, and so following that is a taste of mine. But I say that basically that I put greater weighting on the belief that there's a certain methodology of slaughter which minimizes as much as possible the pain of the animal and the suffering of the animal, but to fulfill a particular objective, which is the evacuation of blood from the animal, so we don't eat carrion meat, that the method of slaughter is a traditional one that's been practiced for hundreds of years and so on and so forth. Now, this debate then doesn't become one of any objective argument saying that, well, I have an objective rationale, which is I can demonstrate like mathematics to show that this is wrong and this is right. But rather, it's just a matter of human taste, of which taste you're going to go with. And I suppose what I want to say is that I respect Andrew's right to hold his taste and hold his beliefs. But at the same time, in the UK and in Europe and so on, other people who want to use their particular taste, not Andrew, but I'm saying other people I've seen who say we must ban kosher slaughter, we must ban halal slaughter because it's not in their taste, it's not part of their religion. This is an imposition of their taste on other people's taste. If you don't want kosher and halal meat, don't eat kosher and halal meat, right? If you don't want to eat meat at all, then don't eat meat at all. All right. So, but really, we must be wary about imposing our taste. I'm not saying I'm obviously doing this. I'm just saying, in general, making comment about the current discussion of this matter in Europe at the moment, where I think in one European country they banned kosher and halal meat slaughter, which is you have no right to impose your taste, because ultimately it is just taste, which is the basis for the morality in Europe, and they shouldn't impose one taste over another when they lack the means of saying one taste is better than another.
I'm going to open you up to the audience. I'm only going to take two questions this time. I don't want to go any questions. Yeah, I'm looking at you. I've got one and then I've got one and then. You want to go first?
Okay, well, I just know that Crockett was one of the seven vegetarian, and he only used to eat meat around for eats. And I know, like, the production of animal meat is actually harming, well, I know, like, for example, a lot of the Brazilian rainforest is getting cut down as a result of over meat consumption in well-developed countries and also rich places, even in developing, well, what is called termed developing countries. And I just know that I'd like to make this as a point to say, like, yeah, I'm of the opinion that there's an over consumption of meat out there.
Yeah.
And I know, like, one of the caliphs, I think it was either Uthman or Umar, I get too confused a lot. He said, like, told the Muslims to only eat meat on Fridays, and I know, like, science has proved that there has been a lot of overconsumption of meat, as you can see with what's been done to the Brazilian rainforest and with the increase in factory farming and the amount of it can be easier to produce. You can produce much more wheat or much more grain or mushrooms or something for much more than it would take to produce a bit of meat. Like the ratio is about 5 to 1, grains and non-meats to meat, to meat ratio.
I think that's really, and it's interesting what you say about, I mean, I was unaware of this aspect of this historical aspect that you bring in about a particular figure from Islamic history. But it's certainly true that across the world, in ancient history as well as in early modern history, meat consumption was obviously much lower. And a great number of philosophers and thinkers within smaller societies, this is true of the small communities that lived in Italy, for example, or in other parts of the Mediterranean, or in China, or in Japan, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago or more recently, there were a great number of thinkers who made the same point that you say that this person in Islamic history made, which is, eat little meat, eat less meat. And I think that's smaller societies that were much more dependent on smaller scale agriculture and much more aware of the importance to eat less, of eating less meat and relying on other crops as well for health and for the health of the environment around us. And it is a problem with mechanised, industrialised production today that has given us the liberty and freedom to eat more, which is not really very good for us. I mean, I think you're absolutely right.
I concur.
There was an hand just behind there. Do you have a question?
Yeah, Andrew. You said something about religious feelings. And from a humanist, before I start, I'm quite tired and a little bit nervous about talking about some people. So
you're doing very well so far.
I apologize as well. But from a Christian point of view, which is in some aspects quite similar to a humanistic point of view, having respect for other people and their beliefs and their preferences, don't you think you may have contradicted yourself in saying religious preferences or how people feel in terms of religion? According to the Bible, it's easier for heaven and earth to pass away than it is for one title across the law to fail. And another part, love your neighbours, you love yourself, translated into, one Greek, the original Greek translation says, love your neighbour for he is as you are. Now, for religious people, or for certain religions and rituals and spiritual beliefs,
why did you? You said I contradicted myself. Why did you say the two? You're going to get to that.
Having respect for animals based on how they feel or their suffering and whatever. Islam, from as old as it is, from time ago, has tried essentially to reduce animal suffering. Same. Today, I'm with Christians who are allowed to eat meat. And so as long as whatever religion it is that believes in a God and believes in everything that God says should happen, if everything they believe in includes having respect for animals and then being able to kill them and eat them after killing them, and they do their utmost to reduce animal suffering, and you say that you would put animal suffering above religious feelings. Haven't you contradicted yourself in saying that people who believe in everything their religion has?
Yeah, I think I understand your question. I'm not quite sure what the two. I'm not sure which two specific things I've said which you think contradict each other. What was the first thing I said?
Should I just
tell me the two things. So on the one hand I said
you would put animal suffering above religious beliefs, yet everybody has the right to believe in whatever they want to.
So I said on the one hand that I put animal suffering above religious beliefs in some circumstances, and yet on the other,
basically, if you tell me that I shouldn't kill animals, or I should have more respect for how the animal dies than I should for my religion, you contradict yourself in saying that human feelings, or you contradicted your original standpoint of being humanistic and being able to believe in
I understand your point. So on the one hand, I've given a certain priority to human beings and their preferences, but on the other, I've said that there are circumstances in which human preferences, including religious ones, should be trumped by animal suffering.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, I think that I was quite careful to say this, I think there are humanists who would take a different approach. I think there are humanists who would say, actually, I value human beings so far above cows that I am willing to put a human being's preference above a cow's suffering. And then there are some people who would say, do you know what, that human being's, you know, not being able to have their cow killed in their preferential way is not the worst thing that's ever going to happen to them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the cow's suffering above the human being's mere preference. Now, of course, then you have to try and think carefully about how badly the violation of that person's preference is going to affect them. And then you've got to try and weigh it against the suffering of the animal, of the other animal concerned. And that's not a simple question, I agree, because real life is hard, and so are moral decisions. You can't just read your moral decisions off a list, you know, you've got to be a whole person and think about these things for yourself. And so I think that my conclusion at the end of that, and I may, you know, this may be wrong, is that I personally look around, for example, the countries where religious slaughter without priest stunning has been banned, where both imams and rabbis have found a way of certifying the food as edible nonetheless, and say, actually, the preferences of the individuals involved don't seem to have been violated to an earth-shaking extent, and they can also always become vegans. But a large amount of animal suffering has been avoided. So I personally, I think, if I were in charge of the world, which I'm not, probably thankfully for many of you, then I would have it that way around. However, there are others who would make an argument for saying, others from a humanist point of view who make an argument for saying, cows aren't all that. Even a human being's preference matters more than a cow's life and suffering, and therefore I come down on the other side of the argument. So it may well be I don't think it's an inconsistency. I don't think I've contradicted myself. What I'm saying is that these moral calculations are very difficult in the real world. And I know where I sit on it. I know where I sit on that position. I would say, let's eliminate animal suffering and put human preferences lower than that. But other people may take a different view on the same basis.
Thank you for that.
Okay, I mean, I would agree to extent of what he said. And basically, it's a debate about preferences between people. And my message to some kind of very hardline politicians and others in Europe and in England who want to ban ritual slaughter, Jews practicing ritual slaughter or Muslims practicing ritual slaughter, is that they don't have any basis except their tastes, and so they should refrain from being bigoted to impose their tastes on other human beings who have different tastes to them or believe it's significant to themselves, and ban them from doing something which ultimately is not objectively black and white if you don't believe in that particular religion, but you know it's just about your taste. So I would say that I think it was it Holland, I think, where the ritual slaughter was banned. I would say to the...
There are five countries now.
There are five countries.
Just to be clear, countries don't ban ritual slaughter. They ban slaughter without pre-stunning. So what they do is require pre-stunning. So I think it's wrong to characterise this as somehow a persecutory measure. It's in every country, it's been led by animal welfare experts.
Yeah, but if you look at the discussion, I mean, it always comes up firstly with, look at them Muslims, right? It's always, it's just like how France said that they said, well, the law is they banned any religious symbols in school. Any religious symbols being shown in school, you know, kids wearing religious symbols. But the debate was led specifically about Muslims. In all these discussions, it was specifically Muslims.
That's true, but that's completely
all right. Yeah, well,
so the debate.
I know, but in Germany, for example, they had issues about male circumcision, and they were going to ban that. Primarily motivated, I think a judge was primarily motivated by Muslims having male circumcision, until many Jewish groups stepped in and said that you're actually now impinging on our rights. Of course, Germany has a history that it doesn't want to repeat with denying Jews their rights. And only because the Jews stepped in and actually saved the Muslims from that, that law didn't come into effect. So we're seeing that many of this discussion And many of these discussions, while there are, you know, those who have a sincere stake in these different points and so on, and are not bigoted and so on and so forth, and that's fine. But there are many those who are led by a very bigoted preconception about Muslims, a dislike, and it's purely based on taste. They want to ban and impose things on people, and I think that kind of intolerance is not acceptable.
If anyone else has got any question, can you just kindly write it down and you can ask at the end?
Well, the next question is going to be really easy.
We're going to hit that topic, and I would like everyone to stick to their time. If you just stick to your time, I'm going to shout at you. The next topic is marriage, and the question is it right from religion to determine who we marry?
It's a question about gay marriage, basically.
You've got 5 minutes. If you go past 5 minutes, you still be shouting.
Okay.
The issue of marriage, the topic title, is it right for religion to determine who we marry? The basic response is, for those who believe in a religion, that religion determines their purpose in life. For the one who subscribes to that religion, their purpose of life is fundamentally important to all their decisions in life, and therefore plays a natural role in determining who they marry. Even atheist humanists believe that their beliefs about morality should affect their decision as to who they marry. The only difference is which set of morals decides this. Atheism, humanism, or other beliefs like Islam, Christianity, or the non-atheistic beliefs. Secondly, we need to understand the purpose of marriage and why it was instituted. It was created initially to regulate the responsibility between reproductive relations between men and women. In Western culture of individualism, marriage has kind of lost all meaning, since the idea of a legally enforceable social commitment that marriage requires is an anathema to individualism and now has no meaning. So how does marriage then differ from the laws governing casual sex between two relative strangers? There is no marriage itself is no longer the document of consent it used to be, and is rather just a vestigial affectation that we imported from our past. The benefits of marriage can be replicated in Western societies through other legal documents like wills, adoption, power of attorney, and tax breaks. However, to change the concept of marriage merely renders it ceasing to be marriage, even if you'd like to keep the name, since by its very definition it is a reproductive commitment between a man and woman, because they are a man and woman wishing to engage in reproductive conduct. Everyone has an equal right to get married to a member of the opposite sex, irregardless of their sexual tastes or where they lie on the Kinsey sex scale. If we are going to believe in a right of marriage, everyone should have the same right of marriage. But the definition of marriage is specific to. Sorry, someone's on the phone. Again, I want to repeat my caveats at the beginning of this presentation, the first quick presentation. I'm only talking about for Muslims who believe in the concept of marriage, and for an Islamic state, and this law only applying on Muslims, not applying on non-Muslims. In an Islamic state, there were discussions historically about Zoroastrians who wanted to practice self-marriage, which is just means ancestral marriage. They can marry their sisters, brothers, fathers, and so on and so forth. And it was a legal opinion that, look, the Zoroastrians that are not Muslim, if they believe that's what they want to do, let them do what they want to do. They're not Muslim. We can't impose our Sharia upon them. So Sharia permits non-Muslims to have whatever law system they want. And according to a historical opinion, Zoroastrians were allowed to practice ancestral marriage, which in the West, you can't do that. And the law is not going to let you do that. So I want to caveat that what I just described only applies to Muslims and is not to be imposed on non-Muslims who don't subscribe to the Islamic worldview. However, if you just want to look historically, the concept of marriage did arise out of the idea of reproduction between the two genders. Adoption is something else. Two friends, or two guy friends, who are just platonic, purely platonic relationship, they can adopt someone. So adoption or wills or power of attorney or any tax break or any other legal instrument that you think marriage brings with it can be replicated without marriage. Really, fundamentally, marriage was just regulating a responsibility between men and women, so the man doesn't just, you could say, impregnate a woman and then say, I don't have any rights to, I don't have any responsibilities, goodbye. That the marriage was there to prevent, that was trying to create a more enlightened reproductive system for human beings beyond just the animalistic. And that's what the definition of marriage was. Now, I said if you want to change that, if you want to change how marriage is practiced outside of male and female, then by definition it's no longer marriage, because that was the definition. You can call it whatever you want, the definition is no longer matching what marriage was, and that's just a point. However, ultimately, what my discussion only applies to Muslims and obviously Christians and Jews who have similarity in this, and not apply to Zoroastrians, atheists, and whoever. Who, if you don't believe in that and you want to practice marriage in other ways or manners, then Islam or Sharia is not here to impose upon you its way. But this is, I'm only merely explaining the Islamic position that it's meant to be about responsibility between the genders because of what issues forth from both the genders, and not just. That they just cohabit. People can cohabit without being married. People can adopt without being married. So why was marriage instituted? It was because of reproduction between male and female. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As a Muslim myself, the theology in Islam believes that marriage is 50% of the religion. And it plays a vital role in that. It's very huge to Muslims to think about marriage. As they grow up, as like their responsibility and rights for each of the male counterparts and female counterparts, to have a role in that, to have each responsibilities and each their own duties in managing that, and the right for religion to determine and who we marry is determined on which religion you follow. If you choose to subscribe to that religion, as Abdullah said, you choose to believe in the beliefs of that religion and to believe in the will of God.
That's
a short point.
Well, marriage in the world we live in today, or rather in the country, let's put it that way, that we live in today, in the world and the country we live in today, marriage is two things. Marriage is obviously a social institution. Marriage has always been a social institution. And in the specific context of the UK, marriage is also a legal institution as well. Now, if we come to marriage as a social institution, it's a bit sort of Eurocentric or Euro-Arabic centric to say that marriage has always been instituted or constituted between one man and one woman. That has been the predominant social institution of marriage, but there are parts of the world and times in history where marriage has been constituted between one woman and a plurality of men, between one man and a plurality of women, between two men and between two women. There are all sorts of social institutions of marriage in Africa, in North America, in South America, in Australasia, in Asia, and also too in Europe and the Arab world in history. It's true that in Europe and the closer Middle East and in North Africa, one man and one woman has been the norm of the social institution of marriage, but there have been a wide variety of social institutions of marriage across that time. Now, that's marriage as a social institution. And to some extent, that's something for people to decide for themselves. As Abdullah said, if people want to have marriage as between a woman and a man in the social aspect, or between two men, or between two women, and don't expect that to have necessarily any legal recognition or wider force in the jurisdiction in which they live, then of course that's up to them, as long as no laws are being broken. Marriage as a legal institution in the UK today, as you know, is defined between two women or two men or a man and a woman. And that contract is formed by the state between those two people for their mutual support and with associated property rights. I think it's right that the marriage contract, marriage as a state institution, has been opened up to couples regardless of their sex and regardless of their sexual orientation. To some extent, the argument for whether that should happen is over. It has happened. That's what marriage is in the UK today, legally, as a legal institution. You can have an argument, of course, if you want to sort of plough up recent history, about whether that should have happened. And there were a large number of religious groups of all sorts of religions that argued that it shouldn't happen, but it has happened. If that argument comes up, I'll answer some questions about it. But otherwise, I want to say what I think marriage primarily as a social institution is in Britain today. So having said that, as a social institution, it has been extremely diverse over the world and across time. And having said also that as a legal institution in Britain today, it has a very specific meaning, the three sorts that I've just mentioned. I also want to say something about its social value today in Britain. And I think that marriage, to most people as a social institution, does not have no meaning because of the modern Europe that we live in, but instead has transformed itself from a relationship about property and parentage and inheritance into a desire to have a stable and loving and committed partnership in this life between either two men or two women or a man and a woman. And I think that's the primary social meaning of marriage today, that love and commitment. And I don't think that the absence of any external arbiter makes it meaningless. I think it is still as meaningful as it ever was.
Thank you. I'm going to begin by firstly questioning why, as you said, you know, for some reason religion is the only reason why an individual would have any purpose to do anything. I find that completely incorrect. As an autonomous individual, as someone who can think, as somebody who can rationalise, it seems very, very sad that religion would be the foundations of whatever purpose I choose to have. And I want to also bring one point. Marriage was just... It was about reproduction. It was about this. It was about that. Living, trying to argue that the ways of the past or that the arguments of the past are true to this date, to argue that the only reason why two people will come together is just to reproduce, is so reductionist. It's so...
materialistic?
Yeah, very, you know, it undermines the reason why two people who love... I mean, I was just writing down some things that we forgot about love, you forgot about affection, you forgot about it being a celebration of two people being together, and you focus on, you know, reproduction. I don't understand why you would miss that out. If, for example, two people are together simply just to reproduce... It's a bit boring, really.
Well, it's not necessarily.
Well, not really. Unless you're rabbits, then, you know. So it's not a necessity. We've moved away from that evolutionary, that naturalistic, that biological means of two people being together. And the other thing is, quickly, why would you give religion such power over the autonomy of individuals who want to be together? Two people have found each other, two people love each other, two people care about each other. Who cares? Regardless.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're our favourite audience.
There we go.
Okay.
So we said, you know, if people love each other, you know, why do they need, you know, to have this kind of marriage document or whatever? And according from your world perspective, I'd reverse that back and say, oh, exactly, why do you need marriage? I mean, do you need to go to the government for your love to be recognized, for your love to be real? No, you don't in the Western culture. So then why all this hullabaloo about marriage? Then why care about it? Just, you know, go to your local lawyer, contract your partner to have the right of attorney, power of attorney if you're on your deathbed or what have you. I mean, why marriage? And they say, well, why should we go back to the ways of the past, look at the ways of the past? But marriage is a word from the past. If you want to rename it and give it a new word to describe how people should be connected to each other or whatever, then in this newfangled ways, then fine. But you're borrowing an old term which had a definition which brought it about. Now, when you say, it seems very materialistic to say that the marriage is just about reproduction. And so, you know, you forget what marriage is. A contract is a contract of first consent between the two and of responsibility, that the man just can't walk away and the woman just can't walk away. In this society, under individualistic societies where you're all autonomous individuals, you don't have no responsibilities to the other person at all whatsoever. You can just walk away and that's it. No one cares. No one's going to... You know, it got so bad that they had to institute child support because, you know, men were just absconding and so they had to force men to pay for their children, right? So that's the thing, right? In an individualistic culture, marriage has no meaning. That's my point. You can replicate the legal consequences of it through many other documents, but marriage itself has no meaning, as argued by yourselves, really. I don't need a government to recognize my love for this person. Right, fine, you've just refuted marriage, the whole concept of it. And the whole point was, it's about reproduction. No, it was about responsibility behind reproduction. It wasn't just meant to be loveless. It was meant to ensure that if that person decides that one day, I don't like my wife anymore as I used to, I can just walk away. No, you just can't walk away as simple as that. That's what it's designed, because human emotion, this love, you're kind of aggrandizing love like it's some eternal godly force. It's not. Humans love one day, they change their mind the next day. Humans are capricious sometimes. All right, that's the problem with human beings. That's why you need a contract to guarantee that they have responsibility and can be held to account. That's the point. As for the other point about looking at other, well, if we go to other cultures, there's been different ideas of marriage. Well, generally, marriage was always between a man and a woman, not necessarily one man and one woman, but between a man and a woman, yes. There could be multiples on either side of that, yes. But also, we can't go look at other cultures to say, well, if one culture somewhere there did it, then that must be acceptable. If that's the case, then we should legalize cannibalism, incest, and rape, because at some point there are other cultures around the world who consider it to be totally fine. You can't just use other cultures somewhere in some far off place to say, well, they did it somewhere at some point in time, that means it's justified. No, it's not. We have an objective basis as Muslims to say, this is wrong, this is right. It's just because someone else does it doesn't mean that we have to do exactly the same. I also would like to say that this also affects other people. Christian counselors who don't believe in same gender couples lose their job if they refuse to give counseling to keep a couple together, which they don't believe in. Now, you know what? The Christian guy, if a Christian doesn't believe it, you shouldn't force them or make them lose their job for following their conscience. Surely, can you not replace him with someone else to take his position? Why did you have to make them lose their job? Why are you imposing it on children in schools to say that this is an acceptable or equal life path? Well, that's actually the government interfering in the values of children, saying this value is right and this value is wrong. The government shouldn't be doing this if it goes against what the children's value believes in, or what their family believes in. So this is an imposition that's come on this. And the last point is, whether we're autonomous individuals, I think science and observation shows that we're not autonomous. There's nothing about us that really actually came direct from us. We came from our genetics, our society, and so on. The only thing you could argue is free will, but free will is not materialistic. You have to believe in a God or a soul to believe in free will. Otherwise, we're just deterministic creatures, but that's a different discussion. Anyway.
Thank you very much.
Wasn't entirely sure what was being said then, but there are some specific points that perhaps to respond to. The reason why I referred to other places and other cultures across the world was not to imply that if anything happens anywhere it's fine, but was to reply to the point that was raised in the beginning against us, that marriage was and always had been between one man and one woman. I wasn't saying that let's look around the world and just do whatever happens, cannibalism and incest and hooray for that. That's a mischaracterization of what I was saying. I was refuting the claim, the false claim, that was made before that marriage was and had always been between one man and one woman. Just on the specific point about the Christian counsellor who was fired from their job, they weren't fired from their job because they'd said they wouldn't counsel same-sex couples. They were fired from their job because they said they would and then they didn't. So they signed the equality policy that said that's what they would do, and then they said they wouldn't after all, and so they were fired for their breach of their contract. Just that's a very small point. But I often find that when these sort of Daily Mail style headlines gets hurled around as if they're typical of everything that's going on, it's wise to consider what the actual facts of those specific cases were. So, oh, someone who likes facts. Great. So, in general, who's facts? Do you have a question? I like a heckler. Did you have something to say?
No, nothing.
Oh.
You said something in respect of culture. You actually... actually, I was wrong to say culture, but the thing is, when you said you had nothing, you weren't referring to culture and marriage itself, you actually were referring to marriages in different places in culture.
But
you weren't talking about norms itself. Secondly, when you refer to Asian history and Greece specifically to per se, you said that
a long time ago.
In respect to equality, you raised the issue of that in ancient Greece, women, you detached the argument of being religion and equality in ancient Greece. The thing is, in ancient Greece, from Michael Scott, who's on History Today, did raise the issue that religion was attached to the fact of women's rights. So when you say facts, I don't really trust it.
So I don't know why you're conflating these. You're completely wrong. You're completely wrong. What I was talking about was isonomia, which is the concept in the Athenian democracy of equality before the law, which was totally Are you shaking your head? Would you like to tell me what isonomia means and where it came from?
No, it's not about that.
So let me finish my point. Okay, so what I was talking about when I talked about isonomia, isonomia is the Greek word which means equality before the law. And it was developed in the Athenian democracy as an idea, a political idea, divorced from any religious or divine context. Now, when I mentioned that, it was in response to the point that had been made on this side, which is to say that the only way you could have an idea of equality was if you had a Christian or Jewish heritage behind you, which you were now employing a pale imitation of. Which bit do you disagree with? Was that point not made? You're shaking your head. It looks very generic, though. That this point was made on this side by Abdullah. The only way in which a concept of equality can make sense is if you have some sort of divine reference point for it, and the only way that a humanist can have a concept of equality is because of traditions of Christian and Jewish thinking about this that went before. Now, in order to refute that point, I gave an example of a pre-Christian, pre-Jewish idea about equality, which was completely disconnected both from belief in God and from religion. Thus, I was attempting to demonstrate that it was false that you needed belief about a God to have a concept of equality. Now, which part of that is incorrect? Which part of that is incorrect? What's that got to do with anything? If whether or not the Greeks were equal was not the question. What your claim was that it was impossible to have a concept of equality if you didn't have a Christian heritage. Now, having a concept of equality is not the same as having an equal society. No society is equal in the world today.
No, I didn't say a concept of equality. I said equality. All humans are equal, but the Greeks didn't believe all humans were equal, and that was my point.
I didn't say they believed that all humans were equal.
Yeah, well, that was my point then. I said
humans were different because you were saying that women were different from men.
That's what the Greeks were saying.
Women are different. Greeks were right.
They
was in the idea that you could have a concept of equality without God. I mean, do you understand that to give an example doesn't mean that you agree with everything that was happening in the world at the time when the example comes from?
Being a fact, when Michael Scott from History Today, who I presume has more validity than what you said,
he specifically stated
at the time, Asian Greece was a religious society and women's rights actually did derive from examples of goddess and women priests. You disregarded that and detached that argument and just focused on a narrow perspective.
Isonomia has nothing to do with equal rights for men and women. It's a concept of equality about citizenship. And that was my example of equality. The example is to say, here is an example of equality that existed without reference to a divine arbiter, without reference to a Judeo-Christian idea or a Muslim idea.
I'm going to move on to the final topic of today, which is faith.
Where are we?
The question says, is it right to force religious practices in faith-based schools?
I'm not going to use 5 minutes. I mean, I think there are in this country we do have religious schools within our state system. My own point of view on this is, the question is it right to force religious practices in faith-based schools? I don't think it is right to force practice in any religious activity. In any school. I think that if activities that are religion-based, like religious worship, for example, or religious instruction, are going to take place in institutions, in state institutions, then I think that those should be voluntary. Because I believe in children's freedom of thought and conscience and religion, and their right to determine their own beliefs in this matter according to their maturity. No one would ever say that very small children were able to have a total free choice in what they did, but according to their maturity. And I think it is a better thing if
anyone, any parent who has beliefs, whether they're humanist beliefs or Muslim beliefs or Jewish or Hindu or Confucian or whatever, to provide for their children's education in those beliefs, both in the home and in the community institution, whether it's temple, church or mosque or the wider community. I think it is wrong to have, especially state schools, that divide children according to religion and often ethnicity within our system and that have practices that separate children from each other.
To me.
What do you think about it?
What do I think? It's a secular argument, and it's a simple thing. Within our education system, within children's education, the reason for faith schools should not exist, in so far to say that in order for children to not, because little young children do not have the maturity to make that decision themselves. To be part of a religion, to be part of a religious group, whether that be Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, Jewish, Christian, whatsoever, you must choose that through rationalization. You know, you must have that own thought to yourself. I hope that, I'm guessing that's a personal thought, that, you know, you should make that decision for yourselves. If, for example, that's been given to you through faith schools, through religious things like that, then obviously I would argue that that was wrong, because within this society, within this more so secular society than we've ever had before, this is the way that it needs to be. I don't think I'm going to use the most of my time. Because
Well, I
time.
Didn't use mine either.
No.
It's a simple argument.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, now this is very specific to, I suppose, the UK, so I'll just chime in on something rather than give the Sharia argument. The Sharia argument would be very simple, is that Jews are allowed to teach their children Jewish beliefs, Christians are allowed to teach their children Christian beliefs, and so on and so forth. You know, we had different communities in Islamic world throughout history who were given the right to teach their children as they saw fit. It was their children, not ours. However, bringing this discussion to UK faith schools, which is now a UK discussion, I will just kind of perhaps advise some consistency. Parents and schools force many things on children, right, as part of their right intellectual moral development. Children are forced to do many things by their parents for their own good. There is no escaping this. Otherwise, we'd have to abolish schools, since most children would probably not prefer to have them or have to be forced to learn maths and science and trigonometry. That's just the nature of it. You know, if you want to ask the kid, what do you feel like doing? He's not going to want to put his head down for, like, oh, I want double maths today. Not going to say that. Okay, in most cases, there might be some kids that love that stuff. Okay, you know, but generally speaking, most kids don't want the discipline or the relatively regimented kind of day of school life. So, but the thing is, because these children are not adults, by British law and by most law systems around the world, including Islamic law, children don't get a right to decide as to what they what generally want to do, for how they should be taught in their education and so on. You can't play truant and say, I'm not going to turn up to school because it got so bad that now there's laws being brought in many countries around the world where the parents will be punished for not making their child go to school, forcing their child against his will to go to school. I think that the child should go to school. I think the child should be educated or homeschooled, as the preference goes for the parent, of course. So the debate should not be what children are, whether they should have a free choice or not. Children don't have a free choice, and until they reach adulthood, I think we can all agree on that basis. The real issue, of course, is religious education, or the reproduction of religious education in the next generation, or preventing of that by those who don't subscribe to a particular religion. And some people might say, well, you know, children, some people might say children are naturally born without religion, so you're now imposing upon them a belief system that's not natural to them. And some people will say that religion is natural amongst human beings, and we're going to have a whole debate as to what is human nature, and then it really becomes a debate as imposing your value systems on other people's children, which is the issue here. And I say, well, the Islamic perspective would be is leave all the children, although people's children alone. Those who are sincere from amongst their children will listen to your message perhaps when they grow up, and they can decide for themselves once they have a position to stand on. They have a position to stand on, then you can juxtapose with your position that you offer them, and they can make an enlightened choice, other than you just saying to the child, you're going to have no other position except my position, and that's freeing you from being imposed upon. Well, no, you're making that imposition in the first place. As for issue of the school, saying schools should be a neutral area, but you see, we pay tax to these schools. As the American Revolutionary said, no taxation without representation. If the religious parents pay tax to schools, to teach their children, then their children should have the beliefs of their parents represented or manifested in some form in their schools, because the parents pay tax. The parents, although, you know, could choose to do homeschooling, but most parents, it's not homeschooling isn't convenient. In homeschooling, there's going to be no neutral, as you might call it, neutral education or a humanist education. It will be whatever the parents teach their children, including atheist parents teaching their children that there is no God. Right? So what I'm going to really argue is that we shouldn't impose upon other parents' children. The parents are the responsible guardians for their children, and by any measure of any society and culture, the parents are the ones who determine what's best for their children. Of course, we do draw a line at you know, killing their children or something like that, or denying their children the right to education, because the children has a right to these things. But as to the type of morals and the moral system, the moral values, that should be the determinant of the parents, what is good for their children. Otherwise, you're going to have a state that dictates to people what they can teach their children and what they can't teach their children. And I think this is slowly happening, and this is a problem, because we all pay tax, and we all should have our representation manifested in what we teach our children in schools. Thank you.
Just a small point to that. Morals are placed upon children from pre-primary education, so from guardians and parents. As a Muslim myself, in the Quran, it states that you have to keep seeking knowledge, just keep seeking knowledge. No matter what it is, you just keep seeking knowledge. And by that judgment, you judge it upon what your beliefs are. And there are like thousands of Muslim scientists, doctors, preachers, from different careers and paths. Children do not decide like what to eat every day, because they can just have burgers every day if they wanted to. They can eat anything they want to if you keep asking them, oh, what do you want to believe in, or what do you want to eat, what do you want to do today? There's no point in that. So I think when it gets to a certain age and seeking knowledge, especially when they have something to fall back on or other belief system they can actually trust or believe in, then they can make the argument whether they want to take on faith schools or not.
Thank you very much.
Just to pick on a few of the arguments there. I think it should be immediately obvious that the argument that because children can't decide everything, we shouldn't let them decide anything, is a completely false argument. There are ways of educating children. In fact, there are whole theories of education based on the principle that children can be educated to make choices and to be discerning and more autonomous, not completely autonomous because none of us are, but more autonomous in their thoughts about the world, in the beliefs they choose to adopt, in the beliefs that they can't resist because they just make sense to them and they have to believe them. And that, I think, is the sort of education that children should have. So to the extent that anything was said on the other side about allowing children to be free in their developing capacities, to make those choices, to give them, to equip them with the skills and aptitudes and experience and the knowledge that they need to make those sorts of informed choices as they develop, I of course agree. But what that has to be contrasted with is what this question is really written down as being about, which is forcing religious practices in state religious schools. And I think that that is wrong. And I think that instead a better way of educating children is not to close down options and force particular religious practices, but to expose them to a wide range of values and beliefs and worldviews in line with their developing capacities. The second sort of dodgy argument that was made was this idea that because religious people pay tax, their beliefs should be represented in their children's state school education. Well, I don't know where you would draw the line at representing parents' beliefs in their children's state education on the fact that they're taxpayers. I mean, parents have all sorts of beliefs. Parents have a diverse range of political beliefs. Some parents are Nazis. Some parents are communists. Some parents are liberals. Some parents, you know, well, everything in between. Some parents have really dodgy views about children and people with disabilities, thinking that it's a terrible punishment for sins in a past life. Some parents think that all black people are genetically inferior to white people because they have, you know, insane racist views. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that by paying their taxes, which everyone's got to do anyway, it's not as if you're greatly virtuous for having paid your taxes, but by paying your taxes you somehow acquire a measure of determination over the curriculum that's taught to your children? I mean, it's ridiculous. So I agree that we shouldn't impose anything on children by way of atheism or humanism or religion. I think the best way to secure that is not to have state-funded religious schools, which, as well as imposing those sorts of practices, divide children from each other. And that's why I would say that the state should certainly not dictate what is taught to children to believe in school, which is why it shouldn't be supporting religious schools, which is another form of the state dictating what children will believe, just one that is in greater conformity with what the other side would like to see, and therefore they support it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. No one's arguing that children should be completely unfree in every aspect of their lives. I mean, I think no parents or most parents wouldn't accept that, and it's just not practical. You just can't control every single aspect of your child's life. Although there are some parents who are bad parents and might try and do that in any society in throughout the world. But we're discussing about in schools. Now, no one is saying that children should be forced to believe in one belief. So if a child adamantly wants to be a Christian, let's say atheist parents shouldn't force him to be atheist. If he's made that choice, you couldn't force someone to change their mind anyway, whatever you do. And so what we're trying to say is basically that children shouldn't be bullied or punished to believing a particular belief. However, we're talking about communal celebration. So there's for example, if there's a communal celebration, let's say there's Christmas for Christians, or there's Hanukkah for Jews, or for Muslims, obviously we have Eid, and the parents will naturally bring their children along to these communal events. Now, no one has a problem with this, so I'm just saying be consistent and say that in schools, when you have assemblies, which are again communal events, that's what we're discussing. We're not discussing that the school should teach particular doctrines or beliefs that the parents believe in. But when these parents come from identifiable communities, of course you can't make a school that will cater to every single individual particular beliefs. It's just practically it's impossible. If we could invent a world where we can do this, then fine, but we can't. So practically speaking, we do it by communities. And generally human beings are not really that autonomous. They're actually very conformist, and they'll mostly kind of conform to certain communities of cultures and practices. And so when you identify that these cultures and communities exist within society and they have representation amongst the population, then children that come from these societies should have their beliefs of their parents catered for, as long as this child says that he believes in it. So if a child says he's comes from a Jewish family, but he became Christian and he doesn't want to attend a Jewish assembly in school, okay, fine. You don't force the kid to go against their belief. You know, possibly that could be a great great resolution. However, if the kid believes if the kid believes in Judaism and you have a Hanukkah assembly, you should allow Hanukkah assemblies or celebrations of that or whatever other celebrations they hold dear. And likewise for Christians and likewise for Muslims and so on, it should be allowed because these are identifiable communal celebrations which their parents come from these communities and replicate. And if you're going to prevent this, saying that we shouldn't allow that, then who decides what values are inculcated in schools? It'll just be purely the state. And do you really trust the state to decide what is good and bad and impose upon the children? So the opposite is still, you go back to the state making an imposition as to what is good and bad and what morals should be taught. Unless you want to believe that no morals should be taught in school and school should only be teaching physics and maths and chemistry, that could be a possible argument I could accept. It would be a consistent argument, but I don't think people will say that children should not be taught morals in school.
Thank you very much. Now I'm going to open the floor to the audience. I know lots of people have got questions already. If I could just see your hands up in the air if you've got questions. And I'm going to give each speaker 2 minutes each to answer your question, and then I'll move on to the next person. I'll start from over there.
It's not a question, it's just a contribution. Now, if we are talking about education in the public sector, I feel that society has so much diversified and so much liberalized that we should allow every faith, you know, for instance, communal activities. If it's Halloween, we should allow them to participate if they want to. However, if I have, for instance, set up an institution based on my faith, and the institution, because of the kind of practices we believe in and our ethics, has emerged as one of the best schools in England, and you want to attend the school that I have created out of my faith, you must be subject to my doctrines, because that is what I use to build the standard of the school. So if you join my institution as a private institution, then I'm not forcing it to you, but this is what we believe in, and this is what has made us who we are. And we must also understand that we are globalizing as a world. So if you want to make your child not believe in other faiths, it's not the best thing, because not believe in per se, but understand their thinking. Because he will, even if he's an employer, will end up employing people who belong to other faiths. And they might say that, well, I can't come to work today because it's a Friday, or I have to go and pray. If you don't understand, if you don't have that understanding, you might think that he's being rude or arrogant or does not like his job or anything. Every faith has the way they understand work, the way their research on faith have some level, some faith, and then their understanding and how their level of faith has an effect on work, has an effect on all these, you know, parameters as well. So I'm an education person. I wouldn't mind at all if it's a state public institution. Let them understand all the faiths that there are. You know, let them understand that, yes, there are lesbians, there are gays, you know, these are the people that you come across. This is how they think. Create platforms like this, even at that level, for them to understand that this is how these people think. Now, when you come to my institution, and it's a Muslim institution, this is how we think. You know, we pray every Friday. You have to join us, unfortunately. You know, you come, you join. It doesn't mean that you have to be a Muslim at the end of the day, but you pray with us. You know, and I went to a Christian institution. You go to worship with them. It doesn't mean that you are a Christian, but you go to worship with them, understand the way the service goes and everything. That way, when you interact with Christians, it opens up your mind. You are not prejudiced. Okay?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I completely agree with that. I mean, you don't have to convince me about education, about religions and beliefs in public schools. I've been a director of the Religious Education Council of England and Wales for 10 years, and working in RE and in teaching about different religions and philosophies for as long, if not longer, than that. And I think it's a vital subject in every school, but certainly in every state-funded, what you call public sector schools. And the British Humanist Association and humanists generally have led the way in the UK in moving from a Christian instruction model in state schools to a model that learns about different religions and beliefs in that way. And of course, when I was talking about schools a moment ago, I was talking about state schools. So, I mean, I also accept what you say about the need for inclusion within state schools, and that, I think, means non-compulsory religious practices, but in you know, private institutions that are established by people to cater for a particular constituency, I think the rules are different. So I entirely agree with you.
Just a little bit. I mean, the question is on faith schools specifically, and so, and then it's, you know, is it right to force religious practice in faith-based schools? If that's the title. So. I suppose then that we might agree that faith-based schools, which are established to cater for a particular faith, should be allowed to do so, and children attending those schools should be allowed to do so. And I think if you even speak to most children, it's not like a case of that you drag them into assemblies kicking and screaming, and they're like, I don't want to go. Most children will just will conform. They've naturally only known the religion of their parents for their lives. They see no problem with it. My experience growing up in schools in England was that children just generally accepted what their parents' religion was, and attend the assemblies. What I would argue for is that in a more plural society that we live in, just make exceptions. So if there's having a Christian assembly, let the Christian assembly go ahead. But if there are Muslims or Jews or atheists, don't force those children to go into assemblies which they don't believe in the basis. And even in Muslim schools, even the ones that were implicated in the Trojan hoax affair, those schools never forced Christians or non-Muslims to go into, or partake in Muslim assemblies, but that was never really focused on. They would just have this hullabaloo about, oh, how dare, Muslim children be subject to, you know, Muslim assemblies in schools and so on and so forth, which was denying the representation of their parents. I'm not saying that's what my other panelists say. I'm just saying that that's what was said in the media, which we probably would agree, you know, it should be taken with a pinch of salt and some pepper and paprika. But I will say this, there is one growing problem, which is that the state is constructing curriculums whereby, for example, it's beginning to teach children that, I'll give an example, that's, say, same-sex marriage is a equal life choice to, you know, different sex marriage. Now, this is the state taking a position and now teaching that position to the children. You could teach the children saying, in the UK, same-sex marriage is legal. That's a factual description. You know, that's how it is, and that's, okay, that's fine. It's a factual description of what's the legal situation in the UK. But to tell the children that it's an equal, acceptable life choice is not being neutral, is now imposing the values. And when I say that, I don't mean to say that the kids should be taught that they have to discriminate or treat people who have that proclivity in a negative way. You shouldn't treat anybody, any human being, in a negative way or in a discriminatory way, but if they have certain beliefs and certain values, they shouldn't be taught by the state values which are not neutral and are basically an imposition on the values that they might be taught by their parents and might be grew up with.
Thank you very much.
Yes, actually my question regarding that, actually that gentleman in his talk, he mentioned several times, even without a God, we can talk about the equality, and he believes in existence. Somebody talk about, my point is, somebody talk about existence when already believe, have not believe, have faith in God, have faith in Creator. Otherwise, you can't talk about equality or moral basis or justice without the existence or without the faith in God. Because, sorry, issue of the equality completely is a very deep, and issue of the existence,
I
very deep.
Your question. I don't think there's any more you can say to make the question clear.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, I certainly don't think that a creator entity is required for existence. I think that, like almost every other process that we've discovered in the universe, it is equally likely that there will turn out to be a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the place where we currently live, which may not be the first universe that's ever existed, may not be the last, and we don't really know enough about it. And I...
That's the point.
Hold on. Moving away from that sort of cosmic level, which I think has very little, if anything, to do with human affairs, to the sort of human questions that you're talking about concepts of equality and social justice, I don't think that you can link concepts of equality and social justice in this here and now small corner of the universe that we live in with those bigger cosmic questions. To me, and I'm just explaining to you how I approach these questions, to me, those questions about the universe, how it developed in the way that it has developed, where the different parts of it came from, how they work and how they're interrelated, to me, they're questions of how the world is. What is out there? Why is it as it is? How do we explain it as far as we can? And we may not ever understand everything because we're limited animals. Those other sorts of questions are not questions in the same way of what is, questions of social justice, questions of equality. To me, they're questions of what matters. What do we feel matters? What do we feel gives meaning to our lives? What do we feel is the right and wrong thing to do in the situations that we find ourselves in where other people are important part of our calculations? And those questions, to me, are entirely to be divorced from questions of the reality of the universe and how that came to be. Now, I entirely accept that if you believe that the universe came into existence through the will of a deity, and beyond that, you know, or you think you know, precisely which specific deity that was, and you also believe that that deity has communicated in some way or another to you personally, or to people whom you know, or to people long ago whose words you believe, what you should do, then those two questions are linked. The question of why the universe is as it is and what we should do here and now are linked. For me, they are two separate questions, and so not linked in any way.
Thank you very much.
I just wanted to, I suppose, clarify what I said, and that's what you just mentioned now. When I said that equality requires a concept, a belief in the concept of God, the Aristotle posited the concept that identical things, you know, should be treated equally, which is self-evident. If something is exactly the same, you know, then two things are exactly the same, they should be treated equally. It's self-evident. But how do you make things equal which are different from each other? From what basis are you going to make things which are different from each other equal or deserve to be treated equally? It's not then self-evident to do so. To then say that human beings, which the Greeks saw that men are not equal to women, not equal to slaves, so they are all not equally, and that is consistent with our concept of equality. That's what the Greeks believed in. But if you want to believe that there's an equality between things which are different or have different attributes, that requires a belief in a God. And if you say, well, because then what are the possibilities? If you say, if it's due to their similarity that makes them equal, then which similarity have you chosen? So, for example, if I say that chair is equal to me because we're both made of matter, we are both similar in that we're made of matter. It's arbitrary. You know, there is no basis for to say why you're equal.
What if the similarity is the relevant similarity? I mean, the similarity between you and the situation. The situation defines relevance. Now, to say that you and the chair have your material nature in common is to point to one of your similarities, but it's to point to an irrelevant similarity. And by making that point now, you attempt to suggest that similarity is always arbitrary, but it isn't.
But what defines relevance?
Situation. Situation defines relevance. If you're saying, here is a job, it requires this particular set of skills, then the relevant similarity between two potential applicants for that job is not the fact they're both made of matter, or they've both got hair, but whether or not they're both capable of doing that job. And that is true whether or not one is a man and one is a woman. So in every situation that we have to make choices, the similarity that we pick out has to be relevant, not arbitrary, and that answers your point.
Okay, so then bringing an example then. So if we're talking about military matters where men have greater strength, greater
some
stamina
men,
and endurance.
Not others.
Okay, sure, but
weaker than a woman bodybuilder.
That's
not Miss World, strong one.
Yeah, all right.
Miss Very Strong, 3 years in a row.
Sure, all right, that's fine. But if we are drawing on who should be inducted into, let's say, military to defend against a particular enemy and so on, then surely there's going to be a disproportionate number of men in there than women, surely, right?
Disproportionate, but is the situation one where you have to make big claims, or can't you assess each case on its merits?
Well, it would depend. I mean, like does the state have enough time to go through every single individual and say, right, what do you feel like, and what is the situation, and so on and so forth? And perhaps, yeah. But then again, perhaps if people aren't given some kind of a narrative and so on, then they're not. They don't see themselves. They're not. They won't become the person that they could become. They won't reach their potential with that narrative. You just say whatever, do what you wish, and they don't know what to do in their life, and they have this existential angst about what am I going to do, what am I not going to do. I mean, what that narrative provides is that it gives them purpose, and it gives them purpose based on human proclivities. I mean, it's like saying no one goes to an ant farm and say, oh, you know, that soldier ant doesn't want to become a soldier anymore. He wants to be a worker ant, or wants to be the queen. You can't just change their role because they don't like it anymore and so on. It's just biology has created that situation. I'm not saying, now I'm only talking about the issues of, for example, in the military. As I said before, intellectually speaking, there's no evidence to say that men and women are different in any way in their capacity to rationalize. And Islam doesn't say that they are different in any way in their capacity to rationalize and think, of course. But in the issue, for example, of coal mining or in military defense.
At the moment,
or,
you said that men and women could both join the army under Islamic.
Yeah, they can.
Oh, well, then
they could, but the obligation is on men, because the proclivities are within the human race are that men are generally, one biologist called it, modified women, as in stronger, you know, more able, you know, more stamina and so on and so forth to survive the rigors of battle or to defend against you know, what have you, the external world. This is what I mean. Biologists, evolutionists are saying, not really me saying this, or just citing my doctrine. But I'll give you another example, right? All right. So let's say equality. Okay. All right. Fine. So does everyone have the same reproductive rights according to your concept of equality? Yeah. Okay. So
hold on. What sort of rights?
Well, reproductive rights.
Well, that's a label for a lot of different rights. I mean, does everyone have the right to proceed with their pregnancy, for example, or does everyone have the right to have sex with whoever they want, or does everyone have the right to use a condom, or does everyone have the
To proceed with their pregnancy.
Proceed with their pregnancy.
Yeah.
Does everyone have the right to do so?
Does anyone have the right to see their child born, or, you know, proceed not aborted, for example?
I think that in most cases, people have the right to proceed with their pregnancy, yes.
Well, what other cases?
Well, there are obviously some very, very difficult cases where a woman wishes to proceed with her pregnancy, but it is almost certain that both she and the baby will die.
Okay, but what if she wants to proceed with her pregnancy, or let's say what she wants to terminate her child, but her partner...
A pregnancy, it's become a child.
Okay, a pregnancy. If she wants to terminate her pregnancy,
yeah.
But her male partner doesn't want that pregnancy to be terminated, does he have a right to see his to see his offspring, you know, become a baby?
Does he have the right to do so?
Yeah, to protect it from being aborted.
I think if we want to
explore, if it's equal rights,
we have to think about the consequences. We have to think about the consequences for the woman. Are we willing, for example, to restrain the woman? Are we willing to tie her down to the bed, as, in, for example, in Romania used to be done when abortion was illegal? Women were literally chained up so that they would be forced to give birth.
No, you could say a punishment if they abort.
So a woman would be punished for having aborted her child.
But that wouldn't secure...
Against the will of the father of that child.
And you would... Well, then you would...
Not the father had the equal right to decide the whether the...
I don't think that a man would have an equal right over a woman's body as a woman now.
And that's exactly the point. You've actually proven the point, is that you say because the woman is of a different condition in the issue of pregnancy, she has different rights or to men. You see, you've actually, although I don't agree with that, that issue of abortion, so in the first place, but I'm just illustrating to you that because of a biological difference, there are different rights given in this society. In this society, you see, man has no choice if he wants to have a child, and his wife or his girlfriend is pregnant, and the girlfriend says, "I don't want a child, I want to abort." Right? He can't do nothing to stop that. His own flesh and blood, the way he helped create, from coming to fruition, to life. He can't do nothing to do that. Whereas she has all the power to decide. And, you know, isn't that an inequality of rights
inequality,
based on what? Well, exactly. I've made my point. Thanks.
I've got a hand over there.
Yeah. I'd like to make a point probably in sword fighting and stuff, it would require more physical strength, but in stuff like guns and stuff, it may not necessarily, well, depending on the type of gun, it may not require as much physical strength. And as I like to say to some people, guns can keep women safe. But one reason why you may not want women on the battlefield more than men is, yeah, in case a woman's pregnant and stuff, you don't want the baby to go as well with the woman in case.
That's not always the case. Handling gun recoil, the weight of the weapon and the magazines and the backpack of your provisions, as well as stamina, differs between men and women, generally speaking, on a general level. Obviously, you might get exceptions to that rule, but generally, men have been shown to have 10% more stamina, obviously greater upper body strength, so they can carry heavy weapons or a weighty weapon for longer, handle its recoil better, so more accurate, and so on and so forth. So there are some advantage even with modern technology. Of course, if you're talking about being a drone controller, as the Americans are wont to do, then maybe there's no difference between a female drone controller and a male drone controller bombing Obama's enemies around the world, of course. But in terms of actual, let's say, infantry combat, or even in tank combat, it would there are differences, even differences in fighter pilots as well, although one could argue that because female fighter pilots are shorter, they can handle more G-force than men, who tend to be taller. And, you know, G-force, it takes your blood from away from your brain as you're climbing. But there are differences, basically, that, for example, infantry roles more suited to men, even in modern day. It hasn't changed.
Thank you.
Sorry, armchair general. Sorry.
Yeah, since
there is no one representing the president on the panel, I just wish to state that in the eyes of God, in the Bible, men and women are created equally. Now, the difference is that responsibility. Now, men have been given more responsibilities than women. Society now is fighting the subject of equality is all the subject of give us equal responsibilities as men. It is not, I mean, we love the women love us. The Bible says that we should love our neighbors as ourselves. We should treat them equally, you know. But when it comes to responsibility, yes, it's all about physiological, biological structure. Can you handle the same responsibilities as a man? Certain jobs are given, or men are prioritizing certain jobs, mainly because research has shown that they are able to do that better than women, and women are able to handle certain jobs better because research has shown that women can handle it better. If research can prove otherwise...
What sort of jobs are you talking about?
Well, that, for instance...
And what research?
For instance, if you take a woman going into army, women are known to be very sympathetic. you know,
more
than
men. What research are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about Hofstede dimension, that talks about feminist society and masculine
okay.
society.
And is that research that women and men are universally identical in this respect?
Sorry?
Are you saying that this is a reason to distinguish between all women and all men?
Well, what I'm stating is that because certain, well, the feminist societies were associated, the research that was done was shown that certain organizations, certain countries that had more females showed certain characteristics. And so if you read carefully about Hofstede's dimensions of culture, it shows that yes, certain societies are more feminist, meaning that they look at the softer side of society. If you send such people, for instance, who personally have got feministic abilities, or if you send females to war, the tendency is that they'll see someone battling, or they will not be able to kill their opponent, or they will not be able, they'll be more sympathetic towards their enemies than men. Men are achievement oriented. Men are
more. This is research conducted at a social level. What has it got to do?
Yes, what I'm saying now is that we are trying to make society equal, basically because society is not fighting for equal responsibilities. That's my opinion. You know, the way we treat women and the way we treat men, if you don't beat your wife, you don't expect your wife to beat you. How you treat your neighbor the same way you, it cuts across. That's a golden rule in every religion. You know, treat your neighbor as you want your neighbor to treat you. That alone could not, if you believe in that, it connotes that equality cuts across every religion. So far as you believe in that golden rule, that treat your neighbor as you want your neighbor to treat you, it means there is equality. Now the difference is responsibility. And that is what everyone is fighting for right now. And women want equal rights, or equal, sorry, responsibilities as men. That is my opinion. It's all about responsibilities, and that is it.
Thank you very much for that.
I just want to say, I mean, okay, when it comes to research as to whether women are more sympathetic or men are more goal-orientated, obviously, there's research is still going back and forth on this currently on sexual dimorphism and obviously, you know, neuroscience and so on. So I won't really comment on that. I'll leave that to the scientists to look at and make those assertions. But what they do witness is certain proclivities. Right, so certain what they did witness, for example, that male and females, women will generally at some point in their careers want to opt to do less work and have more work-life balance, you know, take care of their family. They've observed that in statistics, they've seen that. Even in Sweden, which is very a very, very strong feministic kind of society and so on, they try to equalize women going into doing engineering, for example, at 50% quotas or at least 40% quotas. And they tried to make incentives. As soon as they took those incentives away, it reverted back to being disproportionately male. And there's a whole discussion. I said, well, why was this about? Because our culture doesn't say, we don't encourage women to do women's roles and men to do men's roles. So why is it that women aren't being miners or engineers and as much as men are doing it? And it's just, they've just noticed these proclivities. But I don't think that we should say that women can't be miners because of these proclivities and so on. That's just what they've noticed. There might be something behind just culture and maybe something more innate and biological that determines this to be the case. But that's being debated by scientists at the moment. But what I will say is this. When I talked about narratives, and I think, you know, my esteemed colleagues mentioned that, you know, maybe you should judge things on a case-by-case basis. And I think, well, practically speaking, the state, you know, has never done this. Example, alcohol limits, right? They set an alcohol limit based on what they think that most human beings, if they imbibed beyond this, they would be incapable of driving their car. Right, but there are human beings that can take quite a lot of alcohol before they become inebriated, and others who only a very small amount and they are inebriated. Should you say, why doesn't the state, you know, test everyone for their alcohol tolerance and give a case by case basis to judge everyone? No, it has to give a blanket law based on the on averages or based on the proclivities of human or what have you. It has to give a blanket law because it can't practically judge people on a case by case basis. So you know, that's the point. I'm not really going to argue that women should be withheld from roles which require more goal-orientated focus. Sure. But what I will say is this, right, that this is not even a theological debate between between theologians and atheists. Even amongst atheists, there is a debate about this. Like Christopher Hitchens said, he wouldn't want his wife to go into the world of work because he doesn't want the women to be coarsened by the real world of the world of work. This is what Christopher Hitchens said. So this debate issue is not just between religious people and atheists. Even amongst atheists themselves and evolutionary biologists, there's this debate about whether natural proclivities of men and women differences and whether different roles. This debate is ongoing. It's not as homogenous as some atheists would like to portray. It is different. Of course, he's portrayed it being heteronomous as well. So,
Unfortunately, I won't be able to take any more questions because we've run over our time for tonight. And I would just like to thank everyone who had come out today. And I hope you guys enjoyed yourself and you learned a bit more from the presentation.
I just want to say thank you to the guest speakers.